Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Help me welcome George Romero.
I don't think we really broke ground that way. I mean, I don't think we paved the road for other filmmakers. I think there were, coincidentally, a lot of filmmakers during that period, that 5 or 7 year period, that were making films that were inspired by, you know, what was going on in the world, by a little bit of that anger. And I think we all took different approaches. I don't think any of us were, you know, I think John Carpenter is probably more of a granddaddy to other films that came after than I ever was. You know, I think we were all interested in using the genre to express ourselves, not just to, you know, tell a little scary story. And, you know, certainly Toby and or Wes's early stuff. There were a lot of people that came out around the same time. I don't know that there was, that any of us influenced any of the others.
Do you see any of the younger horror filmmaker using the genre in the way you guys use it at the time, which was really innovative and very revolutionary?
I haven't seen much lately of course I don't get to see everything, but no, I haven't seen it being used that way. It seems that these days it's either eye candy or a lot of special effects. And I don't know, it seems maybe since 9/11 producers have gone back to more gothic stuff, or it's a little less human on human, it's not Scream anymore, it's more things like The Signs and the others. And I think they're trying to find another way to scare people, The Ring. None of it seems to have any sort of real underbelly of social criticism or satire that way. And most of the satire is sort of self-referential to the genre, which I don't like too much.
How would you describe the way that underbelly, that social criticism you just made, evolved in the Dead trilogy, first with Dawn of the Dead, which they will see tomorrow, and then Day of the Dead?
Well, I think it got more and more self-conscious with each film. It's pretty hard to go back to the innocence. You know, the first film, we were able to sort of talk about it, and we were living in that farmhouse, and sitting around going, "Hey, well, that's right." And and basically, the film was innocent. We were able to sort of forget that and go make the movie. And with the second film, people say with Dawn of the Dead, there's this thing hidden underneath about consumerism. Hidden? Give me a break. It's like a pie in the face. So in that sense, the whatever social criticism there was more conscious, and in many cases, I think, even more self-conscious. We were worried about it more. You don't write a line without thinking, what am I saying here exactly? So that's what I mean by being self-conscious. Day, the same way. I mean, I had this conceit for a while that we were doing them in different decades, the 60s, 70s, and the 80s. And I thought that I was trying to, make the outward personalities of the film reflect those decades. And also the sort of mindset. Dawn of the Dead is disco party comic book, and in the 80s when the rich were living upstairs and everybody was down in the cellar someplace, and so I think it reflects that. I don't think of them as sequels per se. They're films that use a similar theme and that reflect the times in which they were made, and try to have a good time with the same monsters, my old buds.
Now, you have a fourth Dead film, which I'm sure everybody wants to hear about. What would reflect about our times?
Well, the funny thing is, I had finished the script before 9-1-1, and then I said, "Oops, I don't think this is exactly right." And I don't know yet whether this is going to happen or not. Everybody keeps saying, "Is there, you know, are you doing Twilight of the Dead?" And what, you know? You know, there basically is no deal on it yet. But I have been working on a script, and I have been trying to change it since 9/11 because I didn't think it was quite pertinent. It was completely about ignoring the problem. You know, it seemed like before 9/11, that's what we were doing. And my idea was that the dead would be homeless, you know, like the homeless. And people got used to them, you know, got used to stepping over them on the way to dinner. That was going to be the idea, basically, ignoring them and trying to live around them. And then after 9/11, I think now we're sort of coming back to ignoring the problem again, but in a different way, sort of like living in an earthquake zone.
Later on, George would be introduced in Tales of Hoffman, which is one of his favorite films. And he's known for being a horror filmmaker, and yet the films he always mentions as the films that were really important for his life are not necessarily horror. One is Tales, another one is The Thing from Another World, and the other one is The Quiet Man. And I want to ask George, what is it about these three films that was so important for him in his youth when he was growing up in New York?
Well, they were among the first films I was allowed to go see alone, with my own 50 cents. And, I was just always in love with movies. And those three particularly just had an effect on me. I love Ford. I mean, The Quiet Man turned me on to Ford. I was allowed to go see The Quiet Man. I grew up in a Catholic family, and, you know, everybody was with The Quiet Man, you know. They said Hail Mary in that movie, you know. and it turned me on to Ford, that film, and turned me on to The Duke as well. So I had very mixed tastes. I just liked movies, and I thought that was just a particularly terrific movie. The Thing was probably, I think at the time, that was the scariest thing that I'd ever seen. Scariest thing I'd ever seen. But also at the same time, just right around the time that The Thing came out, at the RKO Castle Hill and all neighborhood theaters around, I was able to go see the big Universal Monsters of Filmland, big screen. I don't know how many people here have ever seen those movies big screen. They're gorgeous. So that turned me on too, you know, that sort of classical, the more classical style. But The Thing I thought was really scary. And it was the first one that scared me, sitting there in my seat. And, you know, got to me. And Tales of Hoffman is an opera. It's just a beautiful, Michael Powell, that film turned me on to Michael Powell. I had an aunt and uncle who took me to see Tales of Hoffman when it first played in theaters in Manhattan. It's a fantasy film, and so I was able, you know, I related to it on that level, but it turned me on to classical, turned me on to opera. I was just so impressed with that film. Michael Powell, he was working with, you know, not very much money, and certainly no visual effects capability or budget, and was able to do things just with very simple in-camera tricks that were transparent. You know, you could see, that's how they did that. They just double printed that, or they played it in reverse motion. And I think that being able to see through those tricks gave me a little bit of confidence in an ability to, you know, go out and try to really understand the medium. In other words, it wasn't this blow away thing that was unachievable. And so I loved it for that. But I also just, I loved the design of that film and his use of color and the characters. And of course it was a fantasy. I mean, Robert Altman is the best Dracula that ever was, I think. So I hope those of you who've never seen it get a real treat to see it big.
George, you grew up in New York and you started making films here.
Call them that.
Well, you started when you were really little with an 8mm camera and then a 16, and then you went to Pittsburgh. Can you tell us what brought you to Pittsburgh and what made you really decide to make film?
Well, I always loved film, and I always thought you had to be sort of born royalty to get involved in it. And at the time, there were no schools that had any hardware. My dad was a commercial artist, and so I went to Pittsburgh to study painting and design at Carnegie Mellon, Carnegie Tech then. And they had a theater department. So after 3 years of trying to paint, I transferred over to the theater department and got another little sort of, you know, whiff of the grease paint or whatever you call it. A bunch of us got together and made a little film, which never went anywhere. It was a little, we never put a track on it. But we actually finished the two-hour flick, and was an anthology, five stories with a wraparound called Expostulations. I think there may be a couple of clips from it on the other one of the reels that they're going to show. And in looking around for people who might be able to put a soundtrack on that, we met some musicians and some audio guys in Pittsburgh, and we all started to hang out. At the time, cities the size of Pittsburgh had film laboratories because there was no such thing as tape. News was on film. And one of the first jobs, I wasn't even really a job, you know, they gave me a cup of coffee and a few nickels here and there, but I was bicycling. They'd shoot the news film, bring it in, and these guys, you know, smoking cigarettes over the splicing glue, would cut together these news stories, all single system. I'd take the bicycle and run the stuff around. I say bicycling, it wasn't literally because the stations were all right there in town at the time. And that's how I learned from these guys, you know, these guys down in the cellar of this place that were just, you know, living on the fumes of the glue. But that's where I learned how to use the pencil, how to synchronize sound with picture and do all that. So then we kept pushing at it, and we finally, bought some bigger equipment, 16, all 16. But the labs in the labs there did 16, 35, and they were full service labs with sound stages, mixing stages, everything. We were able to make Night of the Living Dead because when we started to make commercials, as we called ourselves, a commercial production company. And at the time, commercials were all live, you know, guys between innings of the ball game drinking beer when that was allowed. And we were the first company to do commercials on film. Well, we had a good success for 2 or 3 years and wound up and then buying more equipment, bought some 35, and then we went broke. but we were able to make Night of the Living Dead with them. And you know, keep going. Made 3 or 4 more films before I met my partner here, Richard Rubenstein. And he made me get serious. And so we did some television for a while. And then before we went back to doing another feature, and then was with Richard that I did Martin and all the things after that up through Day.
You make a very effective use of claustrophobia in Night of the Living Dead. You kind of not use it the same way in Dawn of the Dead. In Day, did you want to go back to recuperate that feeling?
You know, I didn't think too much directly about that. It was more about the themes. You know, the mall is a mall. And, just a different environment. And that, you know, that was so overwhelming that I wasn't really focused or concentrated at all about, well, this is going to be less claustrophobic, and then the next one will be claustrophobic again. And then that one, I was just more concerned with the idea of, you know, being forced to live underground in order to escape the craziness.
Question is, do you find that people tend to overanalyze your film and find things in them that you really, you know, weren't aware of putting in it?
I think there's no question about that. absolutely. I mean, as I said, the you know, most of the message stuff, particularly in the second two, or to me, it's pretty obvious. It's right in your face. And the other stuff that people read into it, sometimes it's astonishing to me. I mean, I've read treatises about all the little details, and if it's there, it's completely subconscious. Sometimes that happens. I mean, you make choices for one reason or another, whether it's choosing an angle or everything, casting, the whole thing. You make choices based on something, but it's usually instinctive and usually pretty much on the fly. As long as you have your sort of your idea, the core of your idea locked in your head, you just have to trust yourself to make all of the other little decisions that go along with it.
Well, the question was pertinent to George's technique from, you know, the shooting and editing and its craft.
And he asked about digital, whether I'm into digital or the new technologies and all that. And I'm not, you know, I'm not attracted to it just for the sake of what it is. In Bruiser, we used probably, Dark Half, I guess, we used a good bit of CG stuff, but that was before, you know, great programs were developed, and it doesn't look very good. It's a couple of the guys that were working on it were not too wonderful. In Bruiser, we used it. I used it almost incidentally, you know, to make bats fly through a scene or to do things that just not obviously affect scenes. Not obviously scenes that require special effects, but just for enhancement, you know, make the sky look better or things like that. And little storytelling points. There's a scene in Bruiser that where there's a boy, it's actually my son, pointing a trident fork to pick out victims at this party. And it just never read. So we went in and put a beam of light on it. And I have to say, I was amazed. When you see that footage, you won't believe that it wasn't really a light. And these guys were great. I love being able to do things like that. I'm not that interested in doing a big effects picture. You know, I don't wake up in the morning and say, God, I can make the Loch Ness Monster now that we can do it well, you know.
Do you have a favorite modern-day horror movie?
Modern day meaning how recent? Last 5 years? I don't know. Boy, favorite? I'm not too blown away. I like, you know, I like John's stuff. You know, I just haven't been really excited about it. I liked Signs, actually. I know you didn't, but I liked it. I thought he sort of went back to basics with it, and, you know, it was things that go bump in the night. I actually saw some similarities to Night. You know, there's this thing, the aliens have invaded the world, and we're looking at it from a farmhouse. I like that. I like Candyman. I love They Live. I don't know if that's going back too far. But every once in a while, you know, something comes along and you go, yo. But not too often.
It's a two-part question. One is pertains to Day of the Dead. George initially wrote the script for a much bigger budgeted film, and then he was forced to cut it almost in half. So he's asking, what would the film would have been like in case you had, you know, the original budget? And the second part of the question is relates to Night of the Living Dead, and he's saying it that at the end of the film he saw the equivalent of a lynching. That reminded me very much of a lynching, and he is asking George if that was intended or is something that he projected on the film.
Well, the second question first. I do think that, you know, I was influenced a little bit by my working at those labs and the news stations. But it was also, it was 1968, you know, it was a very angry time. And so those attitudes, I'm sure, crept in, that whole thing of the guys coming across the field. And then we went to those grainy sort of, you know, almost press-like photographs. I mean, we couldn't figure out how to make them actually litho, so we just put this, you know, grain over them. So definitely that was the idea. I mean, this guy gets gunned down by a posse. You know, zombies are just doing what comes natural. I had written a bigger script. It just would have cost more money. I mean, the attitude of the basic themes in it were the same. But we showed more. There was another society. There was an upper class sort of living up top. And there were bigger corrals for the zombies. And it was just a bigger film with boat action and, you know, a lot more action scenes. But thematically, it stayed the same. But at the time, UATC, the people that financed it, United Film, you know, said to Richard, my partner, you know, hey, well, it budgeted out at around $7 million, I think. And they say, okay, we'll do this for $7 million, but you got to deliver it as an R rating. And if you're willing to work with $3 million, we will put it out unrated. So we decided to rewrite and, you know, just shave it down. That's what happened.
Just to stay on the subject really quickly, Giorgio had a version of Marty, which was actually 2 hours and 45 minutes long, and it's a version he really liked. What was that like? Give us a brief idea.
What was that version of Martin like? Again, it was longer. It had much more narration. It had much more. It was just much more of an exploration. If anyone has ever seen the book, the novelization of Martin, it was much more like that. Again, thematically, very much the same. We tried to cut it down to size. I just wish there was one existing 16mm black and white print of that I wish I still had. But, I got together actually with Ben Barinholtz, who was going to distribute that film. And, we sat in the cutting room, and he gave me his opinions about it, and we worked on it together. And, he's got a pretty good eye for where it's fat. And, I cut it down to something that, I always like it longer. I never think that a film is long enough, so.
How do you feel about the vast influence that Dawn of the Dead had on the Italian horrors of the 70s, films by Dario Argento or Lucio Fulci? Do you like those films?
Well, Dario was around. I mean, Dario was the first money in to produce Dawn of the Dead. So he was around long before that. There were some films that really seemed to use the idea of, the same kind of zombies and just use that phenomenon. For whatever the filmmaker's own reasons were. And I liked a couple of the Fulci films, and I don't pay a lot of attention to it, I have to say. I mean, I'm not a student of the genre that way. But my zombies are, guys that, they're Steeler fans, man.
Well, he's asking about the different versions that Night of the Living Dead had, the 1999 version, and the remake, and then the special edition, and why there are these different versions. And George can illustrate that complicated problem.
Well, yeah, the remake was basically a copyright issue. I mean, we lost the copyright on the original Night of the Living Dead. When we first finished the film, we printed it, made an answer print in Pittsburgh at one of those labs, threw it in the car and brought it to New York to look for somebody to show it. And our title was Night of the Flesh Eaters. And when Walter Reed finally picked up the film, they changed it, and Night of the Living Dead was their title. And we naively had our copyright notice on literally the title card, the overprint. That was the title of the film. And when they changed the title, they never noticed that they also took the copyright off the film. That was our fault. We should have put it, down where it belonged. After 3 or 4 years, people realized that there was no copyright on that film. And we fought it for years in Washington, and we were never able to get the copyright back on it. That's why there were so many... unauthorized copies. Everybody that realized that it was, basically public domain was making copies of it. So the company, Image 10, the original group of people that made the first film, said, we got to try to protect ourselves. Let's do a remake. And that really was the reason for the remake. And so I went along with it and wrote it. And I think Tom did a good job directing it. But it wasn't anybody's desire to go remake the movie. And as far as the 30th anniversary edition, I didn't have anything to do with that. And I just thought that was a bad exercise.
There has been talk about remaking Dawn of the Dead, and have you been contacted about directing, and what are your thoughts on it?
No, I wasn't contacted, but it's Richard, it's my partner at the time, and... He's got the right to do it, and I wish him a lot of luck. I think they're going to take a different approach with it, from what I've heard, and I don't know anything about what's going on with it.
He was asking if there is a widescreen version of Night of the Living Dead, or if it was actually intended for the format you saw it. It was 133.
Video companies and DVD companies, they keep looking for ways to make it different and new, and so you guys will all buy another copy. I can't tell you how many director's cuts I've seen of my stuff that, when I never did a director's cut, and there's never been, there have been a couple of legitimate things. Anchor Bay is pretty good about it. They actually found footage, and they actually found new material. A couple of those copies were legitimately expanded. But half the time, you know, they'll say the widescreen version. Well, when it's not shot widescreen, you know, it's doesn't make any sense, does it? It's like colorizing Night of the Living Dead, you know? The original Night of the Living Dead? That's all library music. I mean, it was literally the Capitol High Cube film score library that we lifted. You know, needle drops. You pay so much per needle drop. And so you, that music can be heard on a million other movies if you listen carefully. I never met the cats that played it, so I don't know how many there were.
The question is, how did he get to cast John Amplas in Martin, as the lead character in Martin?
Oh, there's always Vanilla. It was a script written by another friend of ours, you know, somebody in the group, and was never finished. We were getting pages every once in a while, and so we wound up, shoot, if anyone has ever seen, there's talking about a film called There's Always Vanilla, a.k.a. The Affair. I don't know how many other titles it had, but so we wound up shooting those narrative pieces with Ray in order to try to glue it, you know, make sense, make a little sense out of the story. But there were days that I really enjoyed shooting it, and, you know, it's too bad that it, you know, hasn't been seen more, just for the sake of everybody that worked on it, you know. Casting John was, you know, I had written the script, and really the only actor that I had in mind was my wife, Christine. I saw John in a play in Pittsburgh, and he was magic in the play. He had to do a little bit of mime, a lot of movement, and he had to have that sort of, you know, shy, sullen, you know, just exactly what we needed. It was right there on a platter. John Amplas is also the mime in Knight Riders, and he just has this magical quality.
When you're given a chance, you single out two other films that are your favorite. One is Martin and one is Knight Riders. Why those two films are closer to your heart than others?
So much of why you have a favorite piece of your own work, I think there are probably more than two, but two major components to it. One is how successful you think you were in translating your idea or what you originally had on the page, and how successful you were in being able to do that. Forget whether the film is successful, whether it works, whether it plays to an audience. You have this internal feeling about, well, this is what I set out to do, and that's pretty close. Having nothing to do with, as I say, with whether it works for anybody else, and that affects you yourself. And the other part of it is the experience of making the film, which you cannot separate from the film itself. And so Martin and Knight Riders were both, I mean, man, we were just a family, you know, and we were fighting the dragon. I mean, those productions, they were difficult productions, and we just had a, you know, I can't say we had a wonderful time, but we had this feeling of camaraderie and everybody working towards the same goal. And, you know, I haven't experienced that again until Bruiser. I have the same feeling about Bruiser. And so now Bruiser's, I have written right up there with the other ones as, you know, one of my faves. Because, I think it, whether people get it or not, doesn't matter. I think it's successful to what was on the page. And we had the best time. There wasn't a bad apple in the bunch. We just had a great time doing it. And I think those two things come in, that's what makes your favorite.
He's asking about George's collaboration with special effect artist Tom Savini. How did they meet and how do they work together when they do special effects?
It's funny. Way before even Night of the Living Dead, when we first started to get serious about trying to make movies and started to, you know, buy equipment with our spare money, we were going to make a little drama about two young kids, medieval. I mean, you know, we were trying to do Bergman, Virgin Spring or something like that. And we needed two young teenagers. And what we did was we went around to high schools to look at high school plays. And Tom Savini was in one of those plays. And he was the, you know, the best male actor that we saw. So we, you know, I talked to him. We got together. We hung out a little bit. And, of course, that film never got made. Plans fell apart. Tom took off and was actually a combat photographer in Nam. And one day we were planning Martin. We were already planning it. We already had, Richard had already put the financing together, and we were planning it. Tom walks off the elevator one day, and he knew that we were doing this, and he says, George, watch this. Slashed it open right there in front of all of us. And that's the kind of guy he is, you know. He's just... So what it's like on the set, the second part of the question is Tom is very inventive. He's like this force. And, he loves it when there's a problem. You know, when John Harrison takes a screwdriver in the ear in Dawn, it was to cover a continuity error because we had this guy... with a jacket. Scotty had a jacket around his waist, and then he didn't, so we needed to have him lose the jacket. So we said, well, we'll have a zombie grab him. But, well, then we have to kill the zombie. And it became one of the most memorable moments in the thing.
The editing in Dawn of the Dead is spectacular, and editing seems one of the essential ingredients of success with the first two films. Why didn't you edit Day of the Dead?
I had started to work with Pat. I love editing. If I were starting over, I might decide to just be an editor. I mean, it's my favorite part of the process. Everybody goes home, and you're left alone with all the stuff. And you don't have, you know, there are no politics in that room except when the producers come around and want to see a screening. But I can't say that about my current partner and actually Richard. I mean, I've had wonderful. It's been wonderful working with both of these guys. And I'm talking about the suits. You know, my AD Nikki calls them the pine cones. When they come around, you can't do it. The answer to why I don't do it anymore is you can't. You know, the pine cones want the film the day after it's shot, so you can't do it. But I had also gradually, over the course of several films, developed a really good relationship with Pasquale. And he's, you know, once you have that relationship, once you can shorthand, communicate in shorthand, it's a lot easier to work with somebody. I used to always be reluctant to sort of give it up, you know. What's this guy gonna do? But then on Creepshow, we had a bunch of different editors, and so I was going around from room to room, you know. Paul Hirsch cut the crate, you know, Oscar dude. So I lost some of my inhibitions, and I also, you know, learned how to trust people. And working with Pat is like, you know, working with a brother, you know, I mean, it's maybe easier, probably.
It's about Night of the Living Dead, and about how, for being a very simple film, it didn't overplay most of the convention of the genre. It didn't accentuate the fact that they had a black lead in a Gary Cooper role. It didn't accentuate. There is no exploitation of women. You really played it for Adrika, the blue collar audience. Is that intended?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't make it for a blue collar audience. I just said that I always thought that zombies were the blue collar monsters. They were the you know, the guys, the working Joes of the monster class, or the monster mash. I guess we just were not, you know, we weren't thinking that way. We were thinking more thematically. We were thinking, well, this is a revolution, which is about a revolution. I mean, that's about as deep as we got into that. The new society literally devouring the old. And we got it. We spoke about the, you know, concepts of family and religion and communications systems, all of those things falling apart. I mean, we talked a lot about that, but we weren't out to do an exploitation film in that sense. I mean, we didn't want the zombies, you know, carrying off some Judy, you know, with her trench coat torn open, you know. I mean, that wasn't in our mind. That's not what we were doing. We were trying to do a realistic story about what would happen if people got trapped in this situation in a farmhouse. And if they could talk to each other, they could get out of there. If they would just make the right move, they could get out of there. If they just spoke, you know, there's a car, that she has a car. You know, instead it's this, you know, lack of communication and anger and one-upsmanship and that gets between them. And that for us was much more what the story was about. Where we tried to push the envelope was in the scares and in the, obviously in the banquet scene.
How well did living in Pittsburgh and staying in Pittsburgh, deciding to stay there, has affected your work?
I don't know if it's had any real effect. It's maybe kept out some static. A lot of my friends that have, you know, moved either to the coast, well, mostly to the coast, West Coast, are, you know, you live and breathe the stuff. And I think there are a lot of influences, unconscious influences on you. Oh, this is what the stock that everybody is using now. You know, this new kind of smoke, man, that really makes it look great. And so, you know, there's a lot of that you avoid by being away from it, you know. And I haven't needed to be. I mean, my partner's here in New York, Peter, and, you know, our agent's in L.A., and, you know, I don't need to be there. So I just as soon stay away. Plus, my wife and I have, you know, a couple of kids, and Pittsburgh's a much better place for them. And so I just stayed around. I fell in love with it. I mean, I grew up in New York, and I fled. You know, I never knew about Manhattan. I was a Bronx kid. This was enemy territory. Well, not here, but over there, that was enemy territory. And I fled before I even knew what New York was about. And I got to Pittsburgh, and I saw some sky and some, you know. when I grew up, you'd hear an airplane for 5 minutes and see it for about a second, and then you'd hear it going away for 5 minutes. And Pittsburgh, I just fell in love with it, and I still love it. It's a great city. It's really a great city. Not many people realize, but it's a wonderful place. And it's a very real place. It's very friendly, and there's still a lot of, you know, that old industrial, you know, let's get this job done, man.
In 1968, how did it play to audiences, the scene in Night of the Living Dead where they take all the corpses out of the pickup truck? It must have been really new to the audiences then.
Yeah, they pretty much went, ew! I mean, you know, it wasn't, I don't think anybody thought of it as part of the message or anything. It was a gross out, and it was, you know, partly meant to be. And then again, what I was talking about the other films, how they got a little more self-conscious, I have this justification in my mind for why those sequences belong, because it's a wake-up call. You know, the film's a kind of a romp, comic book, whatever the personality of the individual piece is, and then all of a sudden you get one of these scenes, and it's cold water in the face. And I dug that in MASH, for example, where you're howling, and then all of a sudden you go into that operating room and. There's blood squirting all over the place, and it's just like, holy Jesus. And so that's really what I was trying to do with those scenes. I don't think anyone saw them that way when it first came out. It's also very, you know, it's much easier to take in black and white. Maybe not. I mean, actually, in Dawn, I think that the red is so red and it looks kind of fake.
Yeah, you've said one that your real blood for you is blood in black and white.
Yeah. Well, I grew up with blood being in black and white, you know. Wherever you saw it on the news, or, you know, Brando and on the waterfront when they beat him up, you know, that's real blood, man. Ours was chocolate syrup, however.
What happened? You were supposed to direct the Resident Evil movie.
they didn't like what I did, basically. I mean, Peter and I worked on it intensely for, 10 months, something like that. And it was one of those typical situations where you work with an executive who doesn't have yes power. And he's loving everything and saying, oh, this is great, man. We're going to push this through, and this is great. There's a couple boys upstairs are going to love this. And then finally, you show it to the boss, and he says, what's this? You know, this isn't what I went in. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that's happened. I mean, Peter and I had a housekeeping deal at New Line for 2 years where they just basically, you know, paid us big bucks, gave us an office, and they kept saying, what do you want us to buy for you? So we actually asked them to buy a few properties for us, and they would buy them. The execs would buy them, and they'd actually commission scripts to be written on them. And then you'd wind up in the Bob Shea's office, and he would say, who bought this? I mean, there's no communication. And sometimes, you know, deals fall apart just simply because of that kind of stupidity.
This was right after Dark Half, right?
Right after Dark Half, yeah.
Would you say how the beautiful music box found its way into Night of the Living Dead?
It was at the house. Happy accident, you know. There are so many of those. I mean, that happens a lot, you know.
Is the house still there?
No. The only reason we got to use it was because they were going to tear it down. So they let us, you know, mess it up.
Well, I'd like to thank you, George Romero.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.